It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. With any luck, life is a constant education. Consider world-class chef Eric Ripert. Now, could there be anything he doesn't know at this point about food? Well, for his TV show, Avec Eric, he went to Korea to study temple food and learned some surprising things about the rules in a monastery kitchen.
It's vegan diet with some restrictions, no onion and no garlic. Onions supposedly makes you a bit sleepy and also give you nightmares, according to the tradition. And garlic makes you very sexual. And also, if you want to meditate, it makes your blood very active and it's not very good to be very zen.
Chef Eric Ripert at the Lentil Underground this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Imagine you're a wheat farmer in Montana, and you realize the farming systems that the government has told you for decades will keep your land and your family secure won't be working much longer. Well, this was the realization that came to David Oeen 30 years ago, son of generations of wheat farmers. The realization took him out of ag school and into new ways of thinking about growing food. Meanwhile, Liz Carlisle, a fellow Montanan, had grown up with the idyllic idea of farming life. That is, until she actually talked with farmers. Realizing what she didn't know, Liz carved out a PhD program studying diversified farm systems. Well, that work led her to David Oeen and to her book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Liz, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So, okay, what is the Lentil Underground?
The Lentil Underground is a group of farmers in Montana who decided they didn't want to do commodity industrial wheat anymore. They were going to rotate specialty crops that would revitalize their soil. And they hit on lentils as the key crop in this rotational organic farming system.
So why an underground? I mean, it underground indicates something you want to hide or you know, something that is just not done.
This is an underground in two senses. It's beneath the surface, both in terms of the farms. What I wanted to call attention to in this book is how important it is what's happening literally beneath the earth on our farms and our food systems, what the roots of our crops are doing, but then also what the roots of our societies and our communities are doing, what's happening under the surface of what we hear about in the news or maybe sort of electoral politics with social movements.
So what is happening under the soil?
Lentils are such a great plant because they can actually work with bacteria to make their own fertilizer. So what's happening down there is that the lentils are pulling nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and they're converting it into a plant-available form. And then they exude that nitrogen into the soil, so it's available as a fertilizer both for the lentil plant itself and for the next crop. So you can rotate lentils with a grain, and your grain yields will be higher the next year.
All right, but now what about the other meaning of underground?
Yeah, so in terms of the social underground, I wanted people to understand how much sustainable agriculture enthusiasm there is in middle America, in farming communities. There are a lot of farmers who want to get out of the industrial food system and have really put a lot of effort and innovation into coming up with alternatives. This is the story of a group of people in Montana. They're rotating, in some cases, up to 21 crops. And what they can do as a result is use the plants to provide the services for one another that would otherwise require chemicals.
You talk about the farmer today is between the proverbial rock and hard place. What is that really about?
It's really tough to be a family farmer in the U.S. today for a number of reasons, and it comes down to the corporate consolidation in our food system. It means that corporations are in control at the beginning of the food chain with the seed and with the chemicals, and they're also in control at the other end of the food chain. They're the buyers for farmers' products. And in many cases, they're the only buyer available in a small town, one of these elevators. And so people get stuck in a system where they have to provide a particular type of grain. It's a proprietary seed. The inputs, the herbicides they have to use, those are proprietary. dietary as well. And so they're going into debt to buy all these things, and they're not in control of their own market. And so it's very easy to feel like you're sort of a factory worker and no longer a farmer. And so that's why it's been important for this group of people in Montana to innovate their own farming systems and then develop their own markets, connect directly to eaters.
How did this all begin?
This all began, this Lentil Underground movement. I start the story of the book really in the 70s when the main character, Dave Oyen, comes back to his family farm and wants to convert it to organics. And it really got moving along in the late 80s because of the farm crisis around the grain belt. A number of farmers got stuck in this debt situation. The fertilizer costs were high, the grain prices were low, and because the fertilizer was tied to the fossil fuel economy, that was all dependent on global oil markets. So they wanted to get out of this trap, and they wanted to figure out another way. But it also goes back to agrarian movements. They date back to the beginning of the 20th century, to the farmers' union, to grain pools. This is a part of our agrarian history that I think we too often forget, is how deep our traditions of mutual aid, organizing, cooperating are.
Well, Farmer Dave Oyen seems to be the heart of the book. So why don't you tell us about him?
Dave Oyen is a farmer in Conrad, Montana. He was born and raised there. His parents farmed. His grandparents farmed. But when he was growing up, they were just starting to move to this industrial system, and he didn't want to farm that way, and it wasn't clear that that would be viable because their farm was only 280 acres, and the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, Earl Butz, was saying, get big or get out. So he went to college, and he got interested in the environmental movement. He was reading Rachel Carson, and he was also interested in some of the social change movements at that time. And he realized that his family farm was a great place to start from in changing the world, and that he could figure out a rotation of crops so that he could farm organically. So that's where the story begins, is with Dave experimenting with these crops and eventually hitting on lentils.
And how did the underground begin?
The underground began because Dave realized that he wasn't going to be able to do this alone. He wasn't going to be able to buck the system alone. He needed to build infrastructure. He needed to have a processing plant. He needed to develop a business so that he could market these products to consumers. There was nobody who would buy organic lentils at that time from him. So he had to get together with his neighbors, and they were receptive because they were having some of the same problems. They were worried they were going to go bankrupt. They'd been hearing the same things about their farms not being big enough. And it's a tough area to be an industrial farmer. It's not as productive as an industrial farming area as the Midwest. It doesn't get a lot of rain. The climate is volatile. The soils aren't those mollisols that you see in the Midwest. So they needed a crop that would be resilient to these conditions. And they needed a farming system that worked for them both ecologically and economically.
Now, in the beginning, from what I understand, there was really no support for this. How much did they have to deal with in terms of having roadblocks put in front of them? Or were they just left alone?
I think there were a lot of funny looks when Dave Oyen started doing this in the middle of a relatively traditional sort of conservative farming community. And neighbors were concerned, frankly, about weeds and about the perception that their farming community wasn't clean. And they also just thought it wasn't a viable business model. And I think there were a lot of snickers at the beginning, certainly from the agricultural establishment, from the professors of agriculture, from people involved in the Department of Agriculture in the state. This was just a really out-of-the-box idea from what had been going on and what they thought the trajectory of modern agriculture was going to be. But of course, that's changed a lot as organics has become such a major industry in its own right. And these days, it's not at all unusual for people to be rotating and using cover crops. It's caught on.
And where is the Lentil Underground now?
The Lentil Underground, they developed this business, Timeless Seeds, in the late 80s, Dave and three of his farmer friends. And it's now a $1 million business, and they sell to natural food stores all over the country. And they work with about 20 to 30 growers each season who grow for them. They have a retail line, and they work with chefs. And they're also working with Farm to School in Montana, which is really exciting to get more lentils in school lunches and also at the colleges.
Fascinating story. Liz, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Liz Carlisle's book is Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Liz is a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, since you can never have too many lentil recipes, give our recipe for coriander orange-scented red lentil soup a whirl. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. and get registered for this month's giveaway in the celebration of our 20th anniversary. This month, it's a knife giveaway, a three-piece pro knife set from Zwilling J.A. Henkels. You can get the details and sign up at splendidtable.org. Don't you think it's about time to retire roasted winter vegetables? I mean, they've had their moment, but enough. It's time to bite into something that's crunchy and tart and alive. And that's where spring pickles come into play. Exactly what our correspondent David Leet wanted. So he sat down and chatted with Kathy Borrow, author of Mrs. Wheelbarrow's Practical Pantry, Recipes and Techniques for Year-Round Preserving.
Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hello, David. Nice to be here.
So they say that in spring, a young man's fancy turns to love, but I have a funny feeling in spring, your fancy turns to something very different, doesn't it?
It does. When I walk through the farmer's market, I see all those brand new vegetables, and all they say to me is, pickle me. I do refrigerator pickles and quickles, also the kind of pickles that are shelf-stable so that I can enjoy them year-round, and even lacto-fermented pickles like half-sours.
Okay, so let's talk about refrigerator pickles, but tell me, how do they differ from quickles and traditionally pickled pickles?
I have to admit that I think I made up most of this. But for a quickle for me is something that I can prepare and eat within a day or two. And a refrigerator pickle, I consider something that needs a little more time to brine and develop and is kept in the refrigerator and not on the shelf.
Okay. And how long is that time for extra brining for the refrigerator pickles?
It really depends on what you're pickling. Because a pickle requires that the water in that food be replaced by a salty solution or a vinegar solution through that thing that we used to remember in science class called osmosis.
I remember that.
Right. Some vegetables are more dense, like a cauliflower, and that might require blanching ahead of time and then pickling for 4 or 5 days, whereas small slices of jalapeno might take only a day or two to fully pickle.
And what are some of your favorite varieties of refrigerator pickles? They're nice combinations.
In the spring, I like to pickle tiny carrots. One of the farmers that I know very well here at my farmer's market brings in thinnings from his rows. So he'll have thin little carrots and small scallions and onions and other vegetables that he's pulled from between the others to give them room to grow. So those tiny baby vegetables are beautiful pickled.
Oh, that sounds marvelous. And in the brine that you use, talk a little bit about some of the ingredients, because that can vary tremendously with spices.
Not only with spices, but also with vinegar. I start always with very, very clean, clear, non-chlorinated water. A lot of us have minerals in our water, particularly things like sulfur for people who are working off a well, and those flavors are going to come right through into your pickle. So if your water doesn't taste delicious, buy bottled water to pickle with. Next, I would say the salt is very important. You never want to use iodized table salt because that iodine flavor will come through into your pickles and it will also darken them and it's unreliable. So work with kosher salt or sea salt. And a smaller crystal is going to dissolve more thoroughly. So that's what you want to look for. Next, we look at vinegars. Really, with a refrigerator pickle, you can use any vinegar, although I tend to shy away from fruit vinegars when it comes to pickles. I just can't wrap my mind around
like apple cider vinegar.
Apple cider vinegar I love, but raspberry or strawberry I'm probably not going to use in a pickle.
Okay, strawberry vinegar. Yeah, no.
Right,
work.
No. Bad idea. So I keep always plain white vinegar, apple cider vinegar, and rice wine vinegar to use. And sometimes I even use things like sherry wine vinegar or red wine vinegar.
Ever malt vinegar?
I have used malt vinegar. I find the flavor is a little overwhelming for tender pickles.
Okay.
And then we go to spices. And pickling spice is a wonderful mélange, and you can buy that already done in the grocery store, but I prefer to make my own because most pickling spice has, for me, a little too much allspice. So I cut back on the allspice in mine. It's traditional to have yellow mustard seed, maybe celery seed, maybe dill seed, some allspice, some cinnamon, some red pepper flakes. Those are all kind of traditional into your pickling spice, but I prefer to make my own, and I encourage everybody to find out what they like in a pickle and make their own spice.
So talk to me a little bit. I know there's two here that I have been very fascinated by in your book, the sugar snap carrot and radish. Talk a little bit about that.
I love that pickle. In the early spring, it's got all the crunch that you've been missing all winter. I mean, really, all winter long, we roast our vegetables within an inch of their life, and they're wonderful like that. But don't you just want something to crunch?
Absolutely.
So those radishes and those peas, they're quick to pickle, and it's a very nice side dish or even a topping for a regular green salad.
That's wonderful. And there's also a juniper pickled cocktail onion.
Oh, well, just say Gibson.
Right, exactly. Hello. Hello, Gibson.
Hello. Put it on the side of your martini, and you have a whole new world there. I pickled those onions for several reasons. I'm a big fan of pâté and a sort of plowman's lunch.
Yes,
I like to do that. And the pickled onions that I would buy in the store always had a kind of funny aftertaste. And so I wanted to develop a recipe that wouldn't have that aftertaste and would have more of that really exciting spring flavor of young onions. So this also picks up a little of the juniper from a classic gin, because I do think it belongs in a Gibson.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Kathy, it's a pleasure speaking to you, and I think your book is wonderful, and I wish you great luck with it.
Thank you very much, David.
Kathy Borrow is author of Mrs. Wheelbarrow's Practical Pantry, and she left us with a recipe for sugar snap, carrot, and radish refrigerator pickles and juniper pickled cocktail onions. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Coming up, traveling and eating with Chef Eric Ripert and a pasta lesson with violinist Joshua Bell. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's our 20th anniversary this year, and we're taking that as an opportunity to revisit some of our favorite interviews. Now, one interview I won't forget was with violinist Joshua Bell, the wunderkind who had been winning awards since he began playing violin at age 14. It was 2007 when we met, the year he won a Grammy for his performance in the film The Red Violin. Joshua's new apartment is what brought us together. Now, he was creating his first home with great delight in every detail, including a spectacular kitchen. Now, the missing link here was that Joshua had never had time to learn how to cook, and he asked to learn to make a pasta dish. So I met up with Joshua at a stove in New York City to teach him how to make a pasta that would have been eaten in the 1600s, when that red violin would have been born.
I've always had this idea of having house concerts. I love playing in people's houses for charities or for warm-up concerts, stuff like that. Also involving food, that was my idea. Because I have a couple of friends who are chefs, and I thought the idea of having a concert in the house, have my friends come over, we play, have like a salon, like the old-fashioned salon type, and then have one of my friends, a chef, or me, once you teach me how to cook, I'll involve food and music. I think they go well together.
Oh, I think it'd be great. I mean, I always associate performers and musicians as being people who love good food.
Yeah, I mean, musicians and food, my friends who are non-musicians, whenever they come out with us musicians, they just can't believe how much we eat. And after a concert, there's just nothing like going out to eat with friends after the stress of the concert. But I've always loved food. Even my parents loved food, so they brought me to, I remember my first tour in Europe, I was 14, my parents came along with me, and we went to several great, three-star Michelin restaurants, and I started to really understand, great food at an early age, it's one of my biggest hobbies.
Well, I was thinking, because the Red Violin Concerto is out, and the Red Violin begins, if I'm remembering correctly, in the 1600s in Italy.
That's true. It does. The story begins with a violin maker from that time, sort of a Stradivarius lookalike copy, inspired by Stradivarius. I think this is a fictitious character, but it's around that time. My violin was made in 1713 by Stradivarius. The film takes place sort of around that time, maybe the end of the 17th century. So what did you have in mind?
Well, this is what I was thinking. Why not do a pasta that did come out of a century before that, but would still have been eaten? And the other part of it is, this is a pasta that if you decide you want to make it for friends, they will never have had anything like it, because it's about how people ate at that time.
I have actually no idea how people ate at that time in Italy.
Just really very basic. I do a 45-minute lecture on this, so we're going to do the short version. The short version is, that at that time the tomato hadn't taken hold.
That's okay. Amazing.
If you had any money, you used sugar, because sugar was extremely expensive. Mm. Sugar would appear in dishes from the beginning of the meal to the end.
Interesting.
Things were sweet and savory. So what we're doing is, it's a tagliatelle with caramelized orange and almonds.
Hmm.
What we're going to start out with is we're going to melt the equivalent of a bar of butter, okay,
uh-huh,
in this big skillet.
What happened to olive oil?
Well, olive oil, believe it or not, could be used, but this was a dish of the very wealthy.
Okay.
And if you had butter, that meant you had enough land to raise cows.
Oh.
And butter was a sign of immense wealth.
Hmm.
The other part of it was that much of Italy was fat poor in those days. I mean, pig fat was what most people could afford. So we've got some
I don't want to show off, but I guess we'll still use butter. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you wanted to do, believe it or not, olive oil, a mild olive oil would work with this. And you'll see what
okay.
I mean. Now, this is what I want you to do. Take this and put it in the pan. This is about the equivalent of a bar of butter.
That's a lot of butter.
Yeah, I know. But this is one of those things you're going to eat only occasionally. Now, let me ask you something. I live next door to a violinist, and I know she's very careful of her hands.
Yes.
So we want to keep you away from knives.
I try to stay away from knives as much as possible.
We don't need the knives.
And from cleaning up plates after meals.
What a great way to get out of cleanup. Now I know. I just have to take up an instrument. We're going to light this. There we go. And what we're going to do is melt this butter with a little bit of orange juice. Let me explain the procedure
okay.
we're going to do. We're going to make a caramel, but it's going to become savory with a lot of black pepper.
Okay.
So the play of flavor you've got here is melted butter simmered with orange juice until it caramelizes and sugar is in there.
Okay.
Then a lot of black pepper, a lot of the rind of the orange, which has that bitter but aromatic quality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's balancing against the sweet and the orange. And then finally, the pasta is tossed in with that. But the topping is the really interesting part, because this topping exists on pastas historically from the 1400s well into the end of the 1600s. Equal parts of cheese, sugar, cinnamon, and almonds. Well, a lot of cinnamon, but not a cup. And it's so interesting. You make this pasta, people say, I'm never going to eat it. And they usually end up loving it.
Hmm.
Josh, I want you to stir the butter.
Okay, that I can do.
I'm going to add about a quarter of a cup of orange juice. All right. And we're going to add just about a quarter of a cup of sugar. All right, let's start that melting, and then we're going to add more.
Do I stir this?
Just stir it.
Everything
else? Stir it together. Good. Yeah, we're adding a bit more sugar.
Oh, that's a lot of sugar.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
It's a strange recipe. And I'm adding a bit more of the juice, too, to keep that diluted. There you go.
That's the juice. That's the
orange
juice.
That's just orange juice.
You'll put some rind in there?
We're going to do it in a minute. So you've got all of that orange rind right there.
Mm.
You're basically making a caramel.
Right.
But you're making a very sexy caramel.
This would be, you could put this over ice cream.
That's right. Exactly. Mm. You could put it over panna cotta.
It's still hard for me to imagine Italian cooking without any tomatoes at all. But I guess it came over from North America.
This is the interesting thing. It didn't get adopted with any kind of enthusiasm until the beginning of the 1700s.
Hmm.
And you know the first recorded pasta recipe with tomatoes? 1837.
Amazing.
Okay, look, it's bubbling.
Okay.
All right, now, do you see how the bubbles are getting glossy?
I love the smell of the orange.
Isn't it fabulous? I'm going to give you a little bit more of the orange there, okay? You see how the bubbles are shiny now?
Yeah.
And they're getting bigger? That means that most of the liquid has evaporated and you are boiling pure sugar.
Huh.
And that means that you have extremely concentrated orange flavor. And that's what you want.
Okay.
Now you can stop stirring.
Okay.
Start grating pepper. All right. I'll stir. There we go. You can let this go for a few moments. We want a lot of black pepper.
Yeah? Okay.
Do you like spice?
Sure I do, of course. And I'm putting in what... Feels like a lot of pepper.
You're putting in a lot of black pepper.
I'm not a big pepper user,
Okay.
But I like it. What about salt? You don't put.
We can put salt in now. We can put it in later. Here.
Okay.
But it's the perfect time to salt the pasta water.
Well, I'm such a novice that I don't even know about salting the pasta water.
You're about to be shocked. You're about to be shocked.
I vaguely have
Take the mitt.
Seen that.
You're going to lift the lid.
Okay.
And now, you have there about a cup of salt, and I'd like you to put about a third of it in that pot.
A third of this?
In the pot, yeah. Yeah, wow. It should...
How do I do that?
Just pour. Go for it. And you can't really make a mistake. That's it. Don't be timid. A little bit more.
All
a little
right.
bit more.
Isn't that lethal?
No. Good. Stop.
Okay.
The thing about pasta... Now, don't worry. You're not going to have a heart attack, I promise, because not all of that's going to end up in your body.
Okay.
Now, we want to just let that get up to a good boil. The thing about pasta is that in Italy, the pasta has flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to season your pasta as though you were seasoning a steak or a piece of fish or
right.
a dish of greens. And you put a lot more salt in the pasta water than you think you have to have.
Hmm.
Okay, now the pasta.
Is this, am I putting all of this in?
Yeah, you're putting everything in. That's great. Good. There you go. All right, now what we've got okay. here is the sauce.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah, and the bubbles.
Is it burning yet?
No, it's not
okay.
burning yet. And the way you know it's getting ready is if you pull that wooden spatula across the pan,
right.
it leaves an open...
Uh-huh.
Like a, it leaves like a river behind it in the sense
right.
that it leaves this open area. And that tells you that the sauce has gotten thick enough.
Right.
And now what we're going to do is add, I've got the zest of 3 big oranges in here. And I'm going to add all but a third of it. And they're going to almost fry in there. And then, you notice how this is turning golden?
Mm-hmm.
You see it's getting caramelized?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want you to pour now. Just
orange
pour.
Juice.
Yeah, stand back, because now it's going to spatter a little. Pour.
How much? Tell me.
Stop.
All right.
And now give it a stir and pull it right off the heat. Good. You got it. You did it. Okay.
All
it's
right.
done. We're going to finish off the dish with yeah. the pasta and the topping, but it's done. And the pasta's done.
All right.
Okay. You want to drain most of the water off.
Okay.
Okay. See? And now it goes right into the pan with the sauce. We're going to just toss this together, and I'm going to get the heat on. Because I actually want to almost sauté it. Ooh, there we are. What I want to do now is to throw in some of that orange rind, and it gives it a nice tart flavor.
Mm.
Here, sprinkle a bit more of this Parmigiano. We're putting Parmigiano right on the pasta. And now the amazing part, we're going to put almost an equal amount of sugar on it. More black pepper.
Okay.
And now... these almonds. All right.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah, I can do a
so
tad
almonds.
More. And now could you hand me that cinnamon? This, by the way, is fabulous cinnamon.
Wow.
So let's taste it.
Okay.
Let's taste it. See what you think. And be honest.
Mm.
What do you think?
I've never had anything like that. That is so good.
You like it?
Mm.
Oh, I'm so glad. Whew.
This is an amazing dish.
So this is what we know with the... period sounded like with the violin, but now we know what the period tasted like as well. I think we can stop eating from the serving dish now. Maybe we should get bowls.
Oh, that sounds like a good thing.
Okay.
There are a few of others in the kitchen that might
right.
be jealous of us.
Josh,
right
thanks.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
That was violinist Joshua Bell. Now you can get a taste of that pasta we made. Find the recipe for tagliatelle with caramelized orange and almonds at splendidtable.org. One of the things I enjoy about Chef Eric Repair's cooking channel show, Avec Eric, is that he doesn't do the usual showing us what cooks do. You get the sense that he's learning right along with you. And this is the sign of a real pro, at least in my book. In his latest season, he traveled extensively in Australia and Korea. Contributor Melissa Clark got him into a studio between trips to talk about how his travels inspire his culinary life.
So, Eric, you just got back from taping the last season of Avec Eric. How long were you on the road for the show?
We went to Korea. We spent about 7 days,
mm-hmm.
came back to New York, and then I went to Australia for 19 days. And shot in 6 territories, Northern Territory, Western Australia, Tasmania, in Melbourne, Victoria, and in Sydney.
And when you travel for that long, I guess you're traveling with a group of people and you're all experiencing it together. How much does it change from what you think you're going to experience to what you actually end up with?
Well, Australia for me was a big mystery because I have never been. I had no idea what the country looks like, what I'm going to find there. And I didn't even know the difference in between the Northern Territory and Tasmania. Mm-hmm. So I obviously worked a little bit before the trip. And then when you are on site, whatever you imagine is never as beautiful as what you encounter. And Korea was absolutely magical as well.
Was there anything that you ate that really surprised you, or were you pretty much filled in on what you were going to get?
No, I mean, I eat whatever people bring and decide to cook. It's not in advance that we decide my menu.
It's not scripted. So it's all a surprise as you're...
Yes.
And what were some of the most memorable things?
I have to say, when I was in Korea, I was in a temple and we studied temple food for 2-3 days. I even slept in a monastery as a guest on the floor and woke up at 3 a.m. with them and so on. And it's vegan diet with some restrictions, no onion and no garlic.
No onion and no garlic?
So onions supposedly makes you a bit sleepy and also give you nightmares, according to the tradition. And garlic makes you very sexual.
Ah, okay.
And also, if you want to meditate, it makes your blood very active and it's not very good to be very zen. But the food that they were doing is very interesting because it's food that has to be obviously delicious in a sense, but not addictive because Buddhists cannot be attached to anything. So it has to be delicious, not addictive. You cannot crave that food. And that food is good for your body, to nourish your body. It's good for your soul. And it has everything as medicinal properties. The nuns, because I was with them, could be monks too, in charge of the kitchen and cooking, are harvesting whatever is, or forage, whatever is in season from their garden or from the surroundings. And they put love and compassion and positive thoughts into the food, which is very difficult to prove scientifically.
Yes.
However, one nun claimed that she could see who cooked what and if the person is happy or sad or stressed. And she demonstrated to me that one person was cooking, the food was not with good energies, and she brought the person, talked to her, and it was actually true. But when you master cooking, then you're allowed to go in a garden, which is very interesting because they believe it's much more important to put positive thoughts into the seeds that will become a plant and a life and then end up in a kitchen again. And so the experience was totally fascinating for me.
What about Australia? What were some of the things that you found when you were there?
Australia was fascinating. Depending on the territories, you can have something like very tropical, like Northern Territory of Australia. It's a lot of green papayas and whatever you will find in the tropics. Mm-hmm. They have also what they call wattle seed, which is they grind it, they make a spice. I ate a barramundi,
which is the fish.
The local fish.
Yes.
I tried to catch it and I never...
Too hard to catch.
Too hard to catch, at least for me.
Yeah.
But someone brought it and they wrap it in the bark and put it completely in the fire.
Like a tree bark?
Tree bark that I have never seen before, wet, and then in the coils. So the bark completely burns, but by the time the bark is gone, the fish is ready.
And the bark adds a flavor or just...
Oh, definitely. It's hard to describe because we don't have a reference. Oh, I don't have a reference here. I cannot compare with anything else, but... The fish was absolutely delicious. And the wattle seeds bring this kind of like a nutty, almost like a bit of coffee flavor to it. Mm-hmm. And you can eat that with a green papaya salad the way they do in Asia. But then when we were in Tasmania, it looks like Scandinavia.
Oh, wow. So it's cold. It's cold climate.
Scandinavia in the spring.
Yes, okay.
So the food was completely different. Then I went to Melbourne, and it was a melting pot of cultures like New York, but very influenced by the Middle East and Greece. So a lot of fusion between local ingredients and Middle Eastern food. And Sydney was fascinating because of the seafood, and I have a seafood restaurant. It was just like unbelievable, the products we found in Sydney. Crabs that I have never seen with clothes that are like 5 pounds. I mean, it's like unbelievable seafood. It's not such a thing as Australian food or like Italian cuisine or Spanish cuisine or French cuisine. It's mostly like fusion because, of course, all the immigrants.
So where are you off to next?
For the show, we will go to Puerto Rico. I find the island fascinating. in terms of culture and in terms of beauty. And not too many people think about Puerto Rico anymore. The Caribbean has been attractive in many other islands because of different hotels and so on. But Puerto Rico has a rainforest, has a coast that is very dry, has the city of San Juan, which is absolutely amazing. And old San Juan is a colonial city, beautiful. And the food culture in Puerto Rico is amazing.
Well, we look forward to hearing and seeing it in your next season, the next show.
Yes, I hope so.
Thank you so much, Eric.
My pleasure.
Chef Eric Ripert hosts Avec Eric on the Cooking Channel. Now, he left us with a recipe from his time in Australia. Garlic and rosemary studded lamb with cannellini beans. And you can find it, you should know by now, splendidtable.org. Melissa Clark is a food columnist with the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. We'll be back with your questions and another take on fusion. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's the one across the hall.
We're connecting with you. Find us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. We've got Jen calling from Nashville. Jen, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a question for you about squid ink. One of my favorite restaurants here in Nashville has a squid ink pasta dish that's just beyond amazing. It has clams and sausage in it. And I was poking around Little Eatery in New York, and I found some squid ink. And so I brought it back for my fearless chef friend, and I'm going back to New York, and I think it's time for me to experiment with the squid ink. And I'd just really like to know what foods pair well with it, what applications.
Oh, boy. All right. The thing about squid ink is it's really kind of delicate. And first of all, it goes fabulously with squid. I mean, this is such a simple thing. It's ridiculous. You know, the thing with squid is you cook it 30 seconds or you cook it 45 minutes to an hour and a half. Anything in between is rubber bands. But one of the things that you can do with squid is you can just do a very quick sauté, maybe marinate it with a little red pepper and garlic because it's such a neutral thing in itself. Give it a quick, just the fastest sear in olive oil. Take it out of the pan. Have hot pasta ready to go. And then stir in that squid ink into the pan. Just swish it around and then toss everything together. That's one thing. The other thing is squid ink and new potatoes, you know, red skin potatoes, the kind that are kind of waxy. Steam those potatoes, toss them with olive oil while they're still warm, coarse salt, and then sprinkle them with the squid ink. They look fabulous.
And sound fabulous.
And they are, because the potatoes themselves have a sweet undertone and they're really, really subtle. And that's one thing. The other thing I'm wondering, because, you know, you're there in Nashville. And you've got, you know, the country hams and the cured stuff is so good. And I know squid ink is delicate, but I'm just wondering what would happen if you did a dish of rice or pasta and you did the shards of really good country ham or really lovely dry aged bacon, just shards of it that are crisp. You've pan fried them a little bit. And you've tossed that with some kind of starch and then a generous amount of the squid ink and black pepper.
That sounds good.
Doesn't that sound good? Or butter. That's the other thing. Black pepper and butter, the two together would be fabulous. And you know the other thing that's fun to do with squid ink, I had this in Sicily, was a very delicate chicken broth and then squid ink in it.
And then greens, you know, things like chopped up scallion and little bits of sweet pea. You play that against the squid ink. That could really be really interesting and good.
All of this sounds amazing. Lunchtime yet?
Yeah, exactly. Now, but think about, you know, where do you want that lovely sea sense and what is it going to work with? It's going to work with things that are either subtle or something that has a bit of a kick of spice that'll spark it. You don't want to overwhelm it. And so that's where all those ideas come from.
And perfect.
Yeah. And of course, you know, squid ink on salmon would be really gorgeous.
Oh.
Yeah.
Lots to think about.
You got it.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
I will. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
In a recent show, I got a call from a listener asking about what to do with sauerkraut. And we got an email from Kirsten Schocke. Now, she's one of the authors of a book called Fermented Vegetables. And it turns out this woman and her colleagues make sauerkraut, all kinds of sauerkraut. And they've done a book on all different ways of using it and making it. And what I was intrigued by in the book was the desserts with sauerkraut. Which to me, by the way, seems perfectly logical, because if you think of that sour, tangy crunchiness that sauerkraut has and think about that mixed with sweets, it's kind of a natural in a way. But they used it in some really interesting ways. First of all, coconut macaroons. I mean, can you imagine? Of course, the shreds of coconut, the shreds of the cabbage, but also that just that slight hint of tang. They did a carrot cake where they actually made a carrot kraut, and those were the carrots that you use for the carrot cake, which sounded really intriguing. And then there is a chocolate sauerkraut cake. So I think the book is worthwhile taking a look at. It's called Fermented Vegetables, and Kirsten Schocke is one of the authors. And it's from, I think, Story Press. And we'll have a mention of it up on the website. Okay? Check it out. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and call us, which Ed has just done from Perry, Georgia. Ed, what's up?
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What do you want to talk about?
I have discovered this recently, plantains. What I do is I wait until they're almost black, and people have asked me, what am I doing with rotten bananas on my counter?
Yeah, right.
And so that's when they're at the sweetest. What I do is I cut them in quarter-inch pieces, and I kind of fry them on one side in oil. When I flip them over, I smoosh them with a glass, kind of flatten them out, and then when I drain them, I sprinkle them with salt. And they're really delicious and sweet, but I'd like to know what else I can do with these things.
Oh, these are, that, first of all, that sounds fabulous. And there's no reason you can't flip it over and fry it on the other side and then freckle it with salt. It would be great. But the other thing that can be done with it is you can steam them and maybe steam them. Yeah, you can steam them, cut them up, steam them until they're very soft and they're cooked. And then you can mash that with garlic. And have you ever run across something called achiote? And it's A-C-H-I-O-T-E, I think. And it's a little nubbin of a seed, and it turns everything this orange, and it has sort of a citrus flavor. And that can be worked into it and to color it, but also to flavor it. Or you could add a little bit of tomato to that combination. And it's just fabulous. One of the other things that people do with them is they thin slice them and they pan fry them. And they almost eat them like chips, if you can, yeah. And you can also, again, when they're not quite at the dark, ripe stage, you know, but just almost there, again, steam them, mash them, drain them well, and then you can see if you can take that pulp and pan fry it, mix in with it any kind of seafood or meat, onion, chili, peppers of any kind. Anything that you want. It's like making a crab cake, if you think about it. Okay?
Okay. I was answering my next question before I could ask it.
And you turn it into a main dish, you know, and it's delicious. So you have a lot of ways to go. Think of it as anything you can do with a mashed potato, you can do with this. So
I'm going to try that then.
But you know, you just have to cook them through. Otherwise, they're a little tricky.
Yeah.
Okay. Enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Ed. Bye.
Okay, bye.
As a kid, when Jennifer Ho was asked what her nationality was, she would answer Chinese-Jamaican, because she was. She lived in the States, but her father was from China, her mother from Jamaica. When she became old enough to realize that people were squinting to find the Jamaican in her face, she would continue on with, "My mother is from Jamaica, she speaks Jamaican, and she cooks Jamaican food." Well, Jennifer is now an associate professor of English and comparative literature at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Our contributor, Fred Opie, talked to Jennifer about her adult take on the intersection of culture, identity, and food.
Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, happy to be here.
So, Jennifer, tell me, how does food play a role in your Chinese-Jamaican identity?
I think food plays a crucial role in how I identify as Chinese-Jamaican. Growing up, when I would tell people that I was Chinese-Jamaican, and, you know, kids ask you, like, what are you, right? If you're not white in the United States, kids ask you, what are you? And I would say Chinese-Jamaican, and they kind of look at me funny, like, I'm not really sure if you look Jamaican, right? I mean, they're essentially saying, oh, you look Chinese and you don't look black and I don't understand. But for me, the answer seems simple because partly because I identify with the food that we grew up eating as a child. And the food we grew up eating was Jamaican food, but it also was Chinese. And so it was very common during family gatherings that you'd have stew peas, you'd have jerk chicken, but you'd also always have white rice and you'd have some type of sauteed greens and there might be some barbecued Chinese pork, some cha siu on the side. And the fact that these food items were mingling on the table, not in the kind of fusion-y way that we think of now, but just sort of existing side by side as representatives, I guess you could say, of my two different ethnic backgrounds was completely normal. And it really wasn't until I was an adult that I realized, oh, you know, my family was doing fusion cooking well before that became a big thing.
Can you tell me about how your family arrived in Jamaica?
Sure. Pretty typical, I think, story in the sense that a lot of, you know, poor people, when they don't have other options, they hop on a boat and it takes them someplace where they can make a living. And there is a huge Chinese diaspora around the world who have followed this path. And my grandfather was one of those people who ended up in Jamaica, I think largely because his family came from outside of Hong Kong, and Hong Kong was part of the British Commonwealth, as was Jamaica at that time. So there was an active trade route going between Hong Kong and Jamaica. And he came and he opened up a bakery in downtown Kingston. And it wasn't a Chinese bakery. It was actually a bakery that made things like hardo bread and Jamaican beef patties. So for anyone listening who knows about Jamaican food, it was the Caribbean Bakery, which when I run into people, they sometimes remember my grandfather's bakery, which is nice. And he proceeded to bring over a wife, my grandmother, from Hong Kong, from the same village. And she proceeded to raise 8 children in Kingston. And my mom was one of those children.
So they learned the whole trade or the artisan craft of making Jamaican patties, which to me is the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of Jamaican food. How about you? Is there an aroma that speaks to you of Jamaican food more than any other?
That's a great question. The smell of something stewing in the kitchen. And I don't know that I could point my finger and say that there's a particular spice, maybe a combination of allspice and scotch bonnet and some type of simmering beef. I think that would be what I identify with either oxtail stew or stew peas as being the scent of Jamaica and triggering memories.
Can you tell us a little bit more about stew pea for those that are not familiar with it?
Yeah, so it's generally beef. I can't think that it's ever been made with anything other than beef. So it's a beef stew. And it's very simple. It's beef stew that's been flavored with coconut milk and thyme, sometimes garlic. That's what I add. I don't know if that's a traditional thing to add. You typically should use part of a scotch bonnet or a whole scotch bonnet, depending on how spicy you like your food. And that's stewed down with kidney beans. That's what I use. But in Jamaica, you'd use something called pigeon peas, which is why it's called stew peas. And then You serve it over rice, or you serve it over rice and beans, which again in Jamaica would be pigeon peas, but here I typically use kidney beans. A lot of beans.
Very interesting, very interesting. Jennifer, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Ho is an associate professor in the Department of English and Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Fred Opie is professor of history and foodways at Babson College. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Anthony Bourdain, who said, "Food is everything we are. It's an extension of nationalist feeling, ethnic feeling, your personal history, your province, your region, your tribe, your grandma." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. SplendidTable.org is your source for great recipes, information on anything you heard here today, weekly newsletters, books, and podcasts. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.